But let's, if we can, get started, see if we got any time left to do something other than fellowship, which is really great. And you're going to have a lot of fellowship tonight and at ICE, aren't we, as well? But let me start with a question. Any of you remember the book by Dale Carnegie? What was the title of that book? How to Win Friends and Influence People. Well, we're going to see today that, in a sense, Jesus takes that and turns it on his head. It really ends up being how to lose friends and make enemies, because we're going to see in the first part here of John 6 that he has thousands of people following him, and then with one sermon in the synagogue there in Capernaum, he's almost down to the small handful of men. And so we'll see a great deal about that. First of all, we're going to be looking, and you might turn with me to John 6. We'll get to that in just a minute. This is, of course, the story of him feeding the 5,000. And as a result, we see the crowds are now seeking him more than ever before. Of course, he then takes them to the synagogue, and you're going to see some pictures from where I was in the synagogue about this time last week, a little bit before, of actually where Jesus stood. And this is where now he tells them that the food that they need is not from the world, but from heaven. Then he urges them to believe in him, and we find as a result of that one message, all these thousands of people turn away, and even some of his disciples leave him as well. So a powerful message, obviously, that we're going to be looking at today. And in the process of this, we're also going to have an opportunity to look at what some of the skeptics have said about this passage and give you some answers. So we're going to do a little bit of archaeology, a little bit of apologetics, a little bit of history, a little bit of theology. And this is the one miracle, interestingly enough, that's in all four Gospels, which will be helpful. Because as I go through this, a couple of times you're going to say, well, where do you get that out of John? Well, I'm pulling it out of Matthew or Mark in many cases. And with that as a background, I wanted to kind of help us understand that, first of all, we're going to see him go to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which would be the eastern side, during the time of Passover. And then as a result of that, because of him feeding them, they are hungry. And he then, of course, deals with that. And so in some respects, this first section is a lesson in how to feed a multitude of people with very few resources. So I thought we'd start with a video to just set the context.
Lock it off. Rabbi, let me help you. Don't glory
child barely needs. God will provide. Put God first and everything else will follow. If you hunger for righteousness, you will be filled through me. He said, ask, and it will be given.
Pretty powerful message. Let's, if we can, turn to John 6 and read a little bit about it. We'll just look at the first 7 verses, first of all. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up to the mountain, and there he sat down with the disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand, and lifting up his eyes then, seeing that the large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" And he said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. But Philip answered, 200 denarii would not buy enough bread for each of them to get just a little." We'll continue on, but let's look at that first section here. And as you can see in your handout here, we talk about the test. By the way, if you're new to the class, one of the things you will notice at the bottom there, it says PrestonwoodExamine.org, and that is where this material is on that website. And you could actually, as some of you are doing right now, download it to your smartphone or your tablet, or if you'd like to look at it later, it's available there as well. And we see that many people have been following him. He has already had some miracles that have happened in Cana, in Jerusalem, and in Capernaum. And so now they're following him because they had seen the way he had healed the sick. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about why it seems that Jesus runs into so many sick people on the Sea of Galilee. We'll get to that in just a minute. But for Jesus, it was not the signs and the wonders and the miracles. It was to demonstrate that he was the Messiah. And I mentioned a minute ago this happens during the Passover, and that I think is significant, not only in what he does with the feeding of the 5,000, but back to his message that he gives in the synagogue at Capernaum. Because Passover was a time certainly to reflect on what God did in order to rescue them from the angel of death. But it was also a time in which to reflect upon the fact that God had provided for them the manna, and that comes up later in just a minute. The idea here, of course, is God provided physical bread during that time for the Israelites. Now he's talking about spiritual bread, and this is the ultimate provision for God's people. Now, it says that there were 5,000 men in attendance. Each one of the Gospels gives that figure. But again, we can recognize that if you had also women and children, that number could be 10,000. Some people think it could be as high as 20,000. This may be, in some respects, at the pinnacle of his career if you count by numbers, right? You know, if you are a television evangelist or if you are a traveling evangelist, you say, I spoke to thousands. I mean, he now could have as many as 20,000 people there. And in the midst of this, Jesus asked Philip a question. And so along the way, I'm going to ask some of these kind of out of the blue questions because they give us some good answers. Why did Jesus ask Philip where to buy food? Why not Peter? Why not Andrew? Well, it turns out that Philip, as we learned just a few weeks ago, is from where? Bethsaida. As they travel over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, this desolate place, most everybody now thinks they have a pretty good idea of where it was, the closest town or village was Bethsaida. So he turns to the local guy and said, okay, where are we going to buy food for these individuals? Where would we get bread for these individuals? Because of all of them, he would be most likely to know what's in the village. And this is where he sets up the test, because he is not only testing them, but also, in a sense, demonstrating the need for a miracle. Because frankly, there was not probably enough food, even in Bethsaida, to feed 20,000 people or 10,000 people, whatever they are. There simply was not enough food. Even if they had the money and they went there, they could not. And so I see, as we're going along here, you might put some notes here, but there are some really good application points. And one of those is that God sometimes tests people in the Bible to refine their faith. I put up Genesis 22, for example, Abraham and Isaac, a classic test. In the New Testament, we see that James talks about the fact that God will test people. Matter of fact, in my newest book here, I have a chapter, God actually tests. There will be a test. There are tests in life. And also, 1 Peter talks about that we are tested by trials. And so, we see that here, he is, in a sense, testing Philip. Of course, the other disciples are looking as well, recognizing we have no capacity at this point to actually meet this test. And that, I think, was very good. So, of course, Andrew has a plan. It's not a very good one, but he has a plan, and that is he brings a boy carrying some barley loaves and some small fish. Those fish most likely are tilapia. I actually ate one of those there at the Sea of Galilee. It seems to be the same kind of fish that was there before. But one commentator actually took the time, because remember what he says here. Philip says, 200 denarii would not buy enough food for everyone. And so one commentator went back and said, well, let's see what that might buy. Well, a denarius was basically a day's wages. So when he says 200, he's talking about two-thirds of an annual salary would buy, and the best estimates are about 4,800 quarts of barley or about 1,600 quarts of wheat. Okay, let's just assume that we only have 5,000 people. You could see that right off the bat, that would only be a quart of barley. Can't make a whole lot with that, but if there's 10 to 20,000, you're talking about like a quarter of a quart. Can you imagine making bread with that? Or if you look at 1,600 quarts of wheat, if you wanted to instead use wheat, well, let's say you had 16,000, everybody gets a tenth of a quart. You see what I'm saying? In other words, what effectively would be almost two-thirds of an annual salary of one of those disciples would not give anybody more than maybe like a communion wafer amount of food. So you can see how significant this particular miracle is. Let's go on, because then we see, of course, I think a very important principle, that is, a useless thing can now become important in the hands of Jesus. And I'm not so sure he raised the basket up there and that he preached part of the Sermon on the Mount when he was doing it, but it made for good video for just a minute. But obviously, he tells them to sit down, and he shows them that he is all sufficient. There is no way from a human point of view that the disciples can see that he could meet any of these needs, much less all of these needs, and he does. And I think another application you might want to put in the margin there is Jesus wants to meet our needs. He was there to meet their needs. He's still here today to meet our needs. Interestingly enough, I thought you might add this to your notes here, because I thought about, we learn a little bit about how we should respond when we are faced with challenges by looking at how Jesus responds. And I put down a kind of a 1, 2, 3. When the crowd comes, Jesus welcomes them. Now here, it already has him walking into the crowds. But if you look at it, he's actually there teaching the disciples and they come to him. But he could have said, wait a minute, we're doing theology here. This is the Jesus seminary. We don't have time for you. But instead, as the crowd comes, he welcomes. We should be welcoming people. When then asked by the disciples to send them away, instead he challenges them and tests them and tries to see whether or not this could be a faith experiment. That's a great lesson sometimes with our kids when we sometimes have to share, or with our friends and neighbors, about how God provided in times of need. And then finally, faced with limited resources, Jesus multiplies the resources. So I think some great little principles there, but I'm going to keep moving since we're very tight on time. But it's also, interestingly enough, to ask one more question. A lot of these might come out of the blue, because then you see that he tells them to sit down, 5,000, then he distributes them. And then look at verse 12. Gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. So why does Jesus gather up the leftovers? Well, it's my thinking that, first of all, it was a further lesson to the disciples that not only did I provide, but I provided even more. You know, pressed down, overflowing. You know, when God blesses, he blesses you in ways sometimes far exceeding even your own desires. But second of all, I would say to you that I think the number of baskets is sufficient. Who's in the audience? Jews. They have come over from the other side of the Sea of Galilee. They're all Jewish. That's going to be important in a minute when we talk about a different feeding, a feeding of the 4,000. But here, we're talking to Jews. And here, how many baskets are left over? 12. Why is 12 significant? The 12 tribes of Israel. And this meant something to them. Interestingly enough, a little bit later, when we look at the feeding of the 4,000, we'll see that 7 baskets are left over. But again, I think this is the idea that there's enough to supply the needs of the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, interestingly enough, you might also ask, of all the miracles that are recorded, this is the one miracle that every gospel writer records. Matthew, Mark, and Luke record them. When John writes his gospel, this is after these others have been written. So he is, in some respects, picking and choosing miracles to illustrate a point. Jesus is the living water. Jesus is the bread of the world. Those kinds of things. So why did he, after this one had been written so many times, add this here? And I think that the significance here is that it really goes back to Deuteronomy 18. If you remember last week, we talked about the fact that in Deuteronomy 18, there is this prophecy that there will be a Messiah who will come just like Moses. And there's a very good book by Tim LaHaye called Jesus. Good coffee table book. Great one to maybe buy at Christmas season. Has a whole chapter on all the comparisons between Moses and Jesus. Very significant if you have a Jewish friend as you're witnessing to, because there's almost a perfect match of the things that Moses does and the things that Jesus does. So here, this is the idea that indeed he is the prophet. And now look at this last part here, because at the end of this, look at verse 14. This indeed is the prophet who has come into the world. What they were saying is, this is a fulfillment of Deuteronomy 18. This is a fulfillment that this prophet, being like Moses, is now here. Just as Moses gave us manna from heaven, so Jesus gives us what? Bread from nothing. In some respects, people say that this is one of the greatest miracles, if not the greatest miracle of Jesus. Now, for all of us, none of us can do any of the miracles of Jesus, but on a lot of these, you know, turn water into wine, well, you change one substance into another, you heal a lame man, you straighten his bones. These are all miracles we can't do, but this is one miracle that looks like what? It's creation out of nothing. Have we seen this before? Use a Latin phrase, creation ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. He creates new things. Now, if there was a scientist there, they'd say, wait, that's a violation of the first law of thermodynamics. First law of thermodynamics says what? That matter is neither created nor destroyed. You need to now recognize that when you learn science, neither created nor destroyed unless Jesus is involved, right? Because here he has created something out of what? Nothing. And so again, this is one more thing that has got the attention of these Jews. They've seen the healings, they've seen the miracles, and now they have seen something which is beyond any kind of explanation that they might have. In the midst of this, you might say, well, he'd probably be ready to set up a tabernacle. You know, that's about time we're waiting for Peter to say, okay, let's just put a church right here. We are ready. We've got thousands of people. We can just open the doors. But instead, what do we see in verse 15? Look at verse 15. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. So he goes up into the mountains, kind of where the Golan Heights is. And he now makes an escape really for two reasons. First, the people wanted to carry him off, literally physically, to Jerusalem and proclaim him the king, because what was happening right then? The Passover. A lot of them believed that the Messiah was going to come during the Passover. By the way, he does later, but not then. But notice John mentions this because he wants to add something that the other Gospels did not, and that is to really have a context, but even a foreshadowing of a time when Jesus will go to Jerusalem during the Passover. But not to be the king, but to be the Passover lamb. But there's a second reason, which you pick up from some of the other gospels, and that is the enemies of Christ, Herod in particular, also the Pharisees, wanted to put him to death. Flip back to chapter 5, verse 18, we looked at this last week, in which it talks about the fact that the Pharisees wanted to put him to death. In just a minute, we'll talk about how Herod wanted to put him to death, because Herod, in his mind, thought that this was John the Baptist who rose from the dead. Remember, by this time now, John the Baptist has beheaded John the Baptist. Herod has beheaded John the Baptist, and now he's hearing of these miracles, and he thinks, well, maybe we didn't get the job done. We need to go kill him. So now Jesus is essentially on the run from Herod, who's the son of Herod the Great, and the Pharisees. So that's another reason for him to kind of hightail it out of there. Well, then, starting in verse 16 and following now, we see something very different. And that is, when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into the boat, and started across to the sea to Capernaum. It was dark, and Jesus had not come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. And when they'd rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat. And they were frightened, but he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." Then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at land to which they were going. And so here now we see the beginning of something else, and that is this issue of walking on the water. Interestingly enough, the Sea of Galilee is about 600 feet below sea level. From the Sea of Galilee all the way to the Dead Sea, it's all the lowest parts. As a matter of fact, the Dead Sea is the lowest part on earth. But the distance that they were to cover is about 5 miles. So they're essentially, according to John's recollection there, about the middle of the Sea of Galilee. The other Gospels say that he actually sent them away, because you read this and it kind of looks like, well, the bus took off and he didn't get on the bus, you know. But he actually sends them away. They're rowing across that dark lake, and I've been on that lake at night, and even with some of the lights in the distance, you can see how it'd be very hard to see more than 100 yards in front of you. And now he uses this miracle now to once again address their faith and their fear. And I thought it would be good for just a minute to talk about what that boat was like. One of the things I was able to see just a little over a week ago was what is called the Jesus boat. That's on the left-hand side. Interestingly enough, as people were walking around one day, they saw a piece of wood sticking out, and they began to realize that this may have been a boat. Nobody at the time knew how old it was, but they decided to bring in archaeologists to quickly try to take that boat and all of the parts and pieces around it into this museum, which is where we went, and that's the picture on the left-hand side. And when they carbon dated it, they recognized that this was a boat from the first century. It's been called the Jesus boat. There's no evidence that Jesus was ever in this boat, but it shows you exactly what those boats look like. And on the right-hand side is a boat that was in one of the kibbutzes there at the Sea of Galilee, and it gives you an idea of why it was so scary to be out there. It's not like the ocean, but still, all it takes is a couple of waves. You can see that they don't have real high sides, and so a little bit of a storm as you're kind of rocking around, and then seeing a figure walking on the water, that'd scare anybody, right? I mean, that's Halloween stuff. And so in the midst of this, of course, they see him, and then he gets, of course, into the boat. Of course, this is no ghost or apparition, but again, he says, "It is I, do not be afraid." But there's something that I had always missed. Don't know why it hadn't occurred to me before. Look at verse 21. It says that as soon as they took him in the boat, look at that word, "immediately." Well, in the Greek, "immediately" means now. Where were they when Jesus is in the boat? They're in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. I had missed that before, but other commentators are convinced that the moment he gets in the boat, they're already over there at the shore. It's kind of a small miracle, but for John, he records it as the fact that as soon as Jesus is in the boat, we're at shore. Now you could say, well, maybe it just seemed like a little bit of time, but I think there may be another miracle that most of us kind of missed. While he's walking on the water, he also teleports them, if you will, right to Capernaum. And now, of course, they're in Capernaum, and this is the case. Now we begin to see in verses 22 and following, that the next day they are looking for him. I'll jump over to verse 25. When they found him on the other side of the sea, they said to him, "Rabbi, when did you come here?" And Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you are seeking me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of loaves. Do not labor for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which is the Son of God will give to you, for on him God the Father has set his seal." And so now, the first thing they see them, they've been on the eastern side, now they're on the western side, they're in this little town or village of Capernaum. What's the first question they ask? A theological question? No. They ask, basically, why did you here, and how'd you get into the boat and all those kinds of things. And so now he begins to give a sermon that they were hardly prepared to actually begin to receive. And that brings me back to the question I asked just a few minutes ago. Remember Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People? You could maybe call this sermon, How to Lose Friends and to Make Enemies, because with one message, he is able to whittle down thousands of people to a small handful. Jump ahead to verse 66, and there is where it reminds us in verse 66 that at this point we see that after this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. Very successful. Could have been, prime time kind of pastor, preacher, teacher, rabbi, and with one sermon whittles it down to a handful of individuals. He gives this in a synagogue in Capernaum, and I've had a chance to be there. On the left-hand side, you can see what is actually the synagogue that was built on the one actually that Jesus preached in. And you can see the little sign there that you can actually see where the first century one was, but then in the fourth century, they built another synagogue on top. But you actually know that you are standing right where Jesus was standing when he was preaching that message. And there's kind of a benefit, not only in terms of the Capernaum synagogue, but just a little bit further away is what many people believe is the house of Peter. There's a good reason or two for that. First of all, when the Franciscan archaeologists worked at that, as they dug down first, they found lots of lamps, which you wouldn't expect to find in a house, and they found lots of plaster. It's showing where the plaster is. It was almost like it took a house and turned it into kind of a worship area. But as they dug further down, they found all sorts of fish hooks. So it was obviously owned by a fisherman. But there is some theory that indeed that this may have been the house of Peter. Matter of fact, the tradition goes back that may have been Simon Peter's mother-in-law. But then after this period of time, when the believers were gathered in Capernaum, they turned this house into kind of like house church. So it's got plaster down it and everything, all sorts of lamps. And so if nothing else, there's another possibility there when you were in Capernaum to not only see the synagogue where Jesus preached, but also the house, which at least early tradition says was the house of Peter and was used as a house church. And it's kind of interesting because here you have this massive synagogue and then you got this little small house church, which I suspect was the place where believers probably did meet. Whether it was Peter's house or not, they believed it was. And it shows you how things have changed, because now you go there and the big structures are the churches. But back then, it was the big synagogue and just a little house church. But it shows you the humility of that time. But anyway, interesting enough, notice that the people don't ask a theological question. Instead, they wanted to know when he arrived. And so once again, we see Jesus cutting through all that theological jargon to really get down to the basic issue. It reminds us of Nicodemus in chapter 3. And in verse 26, says, "You are seeking me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of loaves." They're looking for the next lunch, right? Aren't they? And I think a good application point is there's nothing wrong with seeking Jesus, but we need to seek him for the right reasons. And he recognizes now that this is a group of individuals that have seen perhaps more miracles. More miracles perhaps were performed in Capernaum than any other village. And yet, at the very end, we're going to see that Jesus condemns them, not because they reject him like the Pharisees and the Sadducees, but because they're basically ambivalent. They're kind of middle of the road. And we know in Texas, the only thing you find in the middle of the road is yellow line and a dead armadillo. You know, I mean, that's kind of where we are right now. And because they don't react, they don't follow him, he, of course, condemns what happens there. Of course, the second question relates to salvation. They wanted to know what works to do in order to achieve salvation. We see this as well, that they are now starting to think that it is important for them to do certain works. But his answer is that they are to believe in him. And then, interestingly enough, look what they say, "Give us another sign." I thought that was very striking if you think about that, because here, verse 30 and 31, "Then what sign do you do that we may see and believe you? What work do you perform?" Put this in context for just a minute. These are individuals, some of whom have came from Cana. They've seen him turn water into wine. Many of them went with him to Jerusalem and saw him heal an individual, right? We saw that, the lame man. They have seen multiple healings in Capernaum. And I'll get back to why there were so many sick people in Capernaum in just a minute. And interestingly enough, now they have also, most of them, have been over on the other side of the Sea of Galilee and seen him now actually feed 5,000. And what's the question from them? What sign will you perform? As I think illustrates a point that I've made many times in this class, and that is I think all of us think, God, if you would just perform a miracle right now, people would believe. And here we've seen them see more miracles than we would have ever seen ever in a lifetime. And what are they asking for? Another miracle. They receive manna in heaven. This is another thing here, because then they say there, that is, our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness. He gave them bread from heaven to eat. And Jesus now clarifies that and said, no, Moses didn't give you manna. God gave you manna. So what you have about at this point here is something that's really kind of intriguing, because they are supposed to be somewhat theologically sophisticated. This is taking place in a synagogue, what may have been the largest synagogue on the Sea of Galilee. Hopefully the best rabbis were there. And yet, in terms of theology, they really don't get it very much. And so he now turns the question over to the issue of bread. And he talks about manna and bread, but he talks about the fact that he is the bread of life. And it's interesting that we see so many times how bread shows up in the conversations with Jesus. Remember when Jesus is being tempted by Satan, what does Satan first tell him to do? After 40 days, he's pretty hungry. Why don't you turn some of these stones into what? Bread. He talks about, as he teaches the disciples to pray for their daily bread. And now, of course, he explains that he is the bread of life. But here, this is a sermon that basically drives them away. The title of the sermon could be, I'm the bread of life, but it isn't one of those feel-good sermons that sometimes seeker-sensitive churches do, because instead, he now accuses them of indifference. You have seen me and you do not believe. He says Jesus came down. Of course, he teaches that he came down from heaven, does the will of the Father, but they do not believe. And this is back to our point of giving mental assent. Well, at this point, we see one more place, and that is the Jews now, and this is obviously the Jewish leaders break in. Up until now, he's interacting with the general Jewish audience, but now the leaders of the synagogue break in and grumble because he said he was the bread of life and came down from heaven. And how do they respond from that? Is this not Joseph's son? They said, verse 42, is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? Because Nazareth is not that far away from Capernaum. And so now we engage in what sometimes we call an ad hominem argument. You attack the person. Or maybe what's also called a genetic fallacy. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? And so at this point, they don't like the message, so they begin to attack the message giver. Kind of like the elections we've just been through. Aren't you glad the elections are over? Don't have to see any more campaign ads, all those kinds of things. And then, interestingly enough, verse 46, he says something else. No one has seen the Father, which is, I think, striking. Because remember when individuals have wanted to see God, remember Moses, he wanted to see God. What did he say? I want to see you. Show me your glory. And what does God say? Well, if you would shrivel up, you'd look like one of those people in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Just melt, right? You know, I mean, there's no chance. But I'll show you what. I'll put you in the cleft of the rock, and I'll show you what he calls my hindmost parts. And then when Moses comes down out of the mount, his face is glowing even after just seeing a part of that. When some people even see a little bit of a glimmer of God, think of Isaiah. He sees the heavenly vision, which, again, was only a vision, not actuality. What does he say? Holy, holy, holy. I'm undone. I come from a land of men with unclean lips. John, before the revelation that we read and have before, what does he do? So here is this idea that no one has seen the Father, but here he uses this to talk about something else. That people that are in the synagogue are spiritually blind. He's trying to teach them theological lessons. These may be some of the most learned people outside of Jerusalem in this synagogue and Capernaum, and they simply do not get it. And I think it illustrates again the problem that we all face sometimes with spiritual blindness. It goes on to say that he's living bread, and again, the idea that the Israelites ate the manna in the desert, they died because they only had physical bread, but he is the living bread providing eternal life. And ultimately, of course, Jesus provides that through his death, resurrection, as well. And so finally, we see that at the end of this, he has pretty much lost everyone but his disciples. But then we have an interesting set of conversations as well. Because here he says, those who follow him must eat of his body, drink of his blood. They're totally confused. What is this, some kind of human sacrifice kind of thing going on? Because they don't understand that. And so look at verse 60 here. The disciples heard it, and they said, this is a hard saying. Who can listen to it? This is one of the times where I think the ESV could do a little better job, because the Greek word for hard to listen to, the Greek word for hard, really is probably better translated offensive. This is not just a difficult or hard thing to understand. This is offensive of what Jesus is teaching. And so as a result, we see that some of his disciples would not believe his words. Many of them turned away. And then in the midst of this, as now he's beginning to see this exodus of disciples leaving him, he's been at the pinnacle of his success from a numbers point of view, but now he's moving from quantity to quality down to the key. He then turns to the disciples and asks them a very good question. And that is, we see that in verse 57 or 67. Do you want to go away as well? Everybody's leaving. Rats are leaving the ship. People are walking away. I've lost everything that I possibly can have. And here we have one of the great statements by Peter, in which he says, well, to whom would we go? Because only you have words of eternal life. I'm sure there have been some times in your Christian life where you've just said, you know, God is silent. I don't know that God loves me. I'm really struggling with some problem in my life. And sometimes all we can do, like Peter, is say, well, where else would we go? We know the answers are in Jesus. We know God has the answers. I'm not sure I understand it. But where am I going to go? Become a Mormon? Become a Jehovah's Witness? Become a Buddhist? Just become an atheist? I mean, where do you go? And here, the disciples knew that there was nowhere else to go but to find peace and ultimate life and eternal life in Jesus. Well, just before we go, and I want to do my best to end on time, this passage raises lots of questions, and I thought it might be intriguing to you to hear a little bit about this. And the first thing is that we might ask the question about the time and the place. Because we have four different Gospels, and this is one of those times where really all four of the Gospels help answer some questions that sometimes the skeptics raise in some of these atheist websites. There was a book came out a number of years ago called The Life of Christ in Stereo. But since we have all four Gospels, I guess we'd say The Life of Christ in Quadraphonics. Does that work for some of you? Because we have four different messages here. And the first one is, where did the feeding of the 5,000 take place? If you ever go on a tour of Israel, sadly some guides will take you to a place kind of where the Church of the Beatitudes is, near the Mount of Beatitudes, which is on the western side of the Sea of Galilee, and say, this is probably where he fed the 5,000. But if you take seriously the Bible, it says he went across the sea. I'm going to talk about why he did that in just a minute, because it's very important. But again, he went across the sea to the other side, the eastern side. Why is that? Well, Matthew 14 explains that. Because it says that Herod had received word that these miracles Jesus was performing, and so as a result he thought that Jesus was John the Baptist raised from the dead. Which shows you that Herod wasn't really dealing with a full deck. He was one taco shard of a combination plate, or whatever, you know, for him to even have thought that, because Jesus and John the Baptist were at the same time. But nevertheless, he's now convinced that we've got to finish the work. I've already beheaded John the Baptist, but apparently he's risen from the dead, so I need to go kill this guy Jesus. Well, now you have to understand that by going to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, he's outside of the jurisdiction of Herod. The Jordan River was the boundary. There are times when you will see, and I learned this from our guide when we were over there, when it says Jesus went to the other side. He went to the other side to avoid being killed, to avoid being taken prisoner. And so when he's on the other side, he's outside, theoretically at least, of the jurisdiction of Herod. And so he's safe, at least for the moment. Also tells us that he went on a secluded place, and since, as I said, it was the boundary there, it also, we know it's where Bethsaida was, we can see this from Luke 9, we can have a pretty good idea of where indeed he fed the 5,000. Interestingly enough, because the Bible gives us enough detail so that we can actually say where it was. Matter of fact, when we were over there, we also saw the one place where the pigs went off the cliff, because there's really only one place where the cliff is deep enough that you could have the cliff work and actually kill off all of these pigs that had the demon into them. So that's another part of that as well. Well, then also, interesting enough, John and Mark provide two more important details. First of all, Mark 6 tells us that he instructed the people to sit down on green grass. That's one place where the video doesn't work, because all you see is a lot of stone. But it says in Mark that they actually sat down on green grass. Well, if you've ever traveled in the Holy Land, you know it's only green once. And that's after the rainy season, and that's after what we would call winter. And so the only time you're going to get green grass, the only time that part of the Sea of Galilee is going to look more like Scotland than like Israel, is right after the rains, and it's green grass. John adds to it, of course, the fact that it's the Passover, which was in March and April, so we know that the miracle took place in spring. So we know where it took place, and we know approximately when it took place. And that leads us to one last question before we wind it down for today, and that is the feeding of the 4,000. You might wonder why that's in there. You have the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. That seems kind of redundant or repetitious or saying the same thing more than once, you know, as the joke goes. And I mean, obviously, why do you have two feedings? Why is that so important? And it's recorded both in Matthew and Mark, which is fortunate because you can imagine if Matthew and Mark only recorded the feeding of the 4,000 and Luke and John recorded a feeding of the 5,000, you know your atheist friends would say, well, then you've got an error in the Bible here. But the fact that they record both of those shows that there's not an issue. But again, why did they record two miraculous feedings? Well, if you go to Matthew and Mark, you will see that this is preceded by Jesus being in the district of Tyre and Sidon, which is kind of in the upper northwest corner. And this is where we see that the Canaanite woman comes to him, approaches him to heal her daughter. He eventually does. And all the people around her are all Canaanites. They're all what? Pagans. They're all Gentiles. And so as a result, up until now, the disciples of Jesus assume that Jesus came only for the house of Israel. So the feeding of the 5,000, he feeds the Jews. And we have 12 baskets representing the 12 tribes of Israel. But Jesus now travels to the northern part of a city called the Decapolis. There were 10 cities on the kind of the eastern side of that. And so he's still in pagan land, if you will. And he now is healing all sorts of people there, which comes us back. Why is it Jesus always runs into so many sick people? Because there were hot springs there. Think about even hot springs in Arkansas. Who goes to the hot springs in Arkansas? People that what? Have diseases. And there are a number of hot springs near that. And so as a result, the hot springs around the Sea of Galilee just attracted all of these people that were lame and sick and leprous. And so in a sense, Jesus now comes into it and he's surrounded by sick people again and heals all of them at the hot springs. But then he does something else. Because he's now healed those pagans, the same thing has happened now with the pagans that happened with the Jews. Remember, he's healed all the Jews in Capernaum, people with leprosy and everything. And what do? They follow him. Well, now all the pagans are being healed by Jesus. And what do? Well, then again, they follow him. So this time, again, Jesus announced that they need to feed the people before sending them away. This time the disciples seem a little more ready because they actually now have a small supply of bread and fish, but again, not enough. The boy had, you know, just a few pieces of bread and two fish. They have a few more, but now he feeds those 4,000, but they are what? Gentiles. And as they collect up the baskets, how many do they have? Seven. Seven is the number of completeness. That is, I've completed my work. So Jesus feeds the 5,000 for the Jews. He feeds the 4,000 for the pagans. And as we'll see in just a few weeks, John 10 is where he is instructing the disciples because they still miss the idea. I have other sheep which are not of this fold, but I must bring them also. And this is something that John has been talking about over the last couple of weeks. That Jesus came not just for the Jews, but he came for the whole world. John 3:16. And so again, I think you can see why we have both the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. Maybe I've answered more questions than you ever had before, but these are very important questions that surface, and it shows you how history and archaeology and theology all come together in a way that helps us understand the gospel message. Next week, we're going to look at John 7, and we're going to see perhaps one of the most significant other sermons now to a hostile audience. His Sermon on the Mount, of course, is the longest sermon, and he's speaking to those who want to believe, but now Jesus begins to raise fundamental questions with the Jewish hierarchy. They question, how did a man have such authority when no one has ever taught him? And he responds that his knowledge and authority comes from the Father. So next week, we'll see what Jesus has to say as he confronts the hostility of the Jews, the Pharisees, and the Sadducees. Parker?